This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and by now, many of our listeners may already be joined in their homes by brothers and sisters and grandparents, aunts and uncles, cousins, in-laws. If they're not there yet, they're coming. Anyway, naturally, our Movies on the Radio theme this month is family. And we got a lot of submissions on this topic. Listeners saw a version of their own family struggles splashed across the silver screen. And as we all know, family dynamics make for great drama and comedy. With me again to discuss our listener selections are Marcia Gordon and Laura Boies. Laura Boies, film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. Welcome back, Laura.
Thank you, Frank.
And Marcia Gordon, a film professor at North Carolina State. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
Let me start with you and talk about this broad palette, really. Lots of kinds of family films, as you might expect.
Yeah, I mean, there's the kind of clear categories of the comedies. There seem to be a lot of comedies about family, probably because it's easier to laugh at some of the difficulties of family. And then the drama. And as I was thinking a little bit about this topic, I was thinking, back on film history, and even a film as important to American film history like Birth of a Nation, which is a complex, controversial film because of its handling of racial representation in particular, but it's about two families who are divided by civil war and strife, and then all of the kind of national politics that have to do as much with the personal as anything.
Well, this is particularly appropriate for Thanksgiving, because first of all, so many of these films focus around the family table and the drama that happens during an extended family meal. And this is where conflicts come to the surface, as many of you will be realizing tomorrow. I know during the Vietnam War, some families were rent in half and never really recovered from the arguments over the dinner table over these extremely incendiary topics.
Yeah, no politics during Thanksgiving.
No, I'm sure that won't happen, and no wine either. And I'm hoping that all of our listeners return to us after the holidays are over and that everybody makes it through this holiday season.
Well, L-tryptophan is a little bit soporific, so we're going to have to rely on that.
We'll see how that plays out. But it is the atomic structure. I mean, the atom of drama, right? I mean, here's where all, as you say, arguments, all tensions, and love ultimately begins. And so you can't imagine why you wouldn't start there.
It is, in fact, the genesis.
There you go. Well, let's start with our very first listener pick, and this would be the film Parenthood.
My name's Minna Silverberg, and I'm from Durham, North Carolina. The movie that I really love about families is Parenthood. I think it's odd when I look back, because I loved it even before I was a parent. Somehow I always related to the main character's fears or anxieties about the ups and downs of life. But now that I am a parent, I relate even more to his fears about doing the wrong thing and his catastrophic imaginings about what that will lead to.
Why'd you make me play second base? Someone crashed the roof of the bell tower with the rifle!
It's Tim and Bethlehem! His father totally screwed him up! What's he yelling?
You made me play second base!
Shot, son. It's important to be supportive. Come on, let's sing one of the old tunes. When you're sliding into home and your pants are full of foam, diarrhea.
Okay, there we go. The 1989 film Parenthood. Steve Martin, obviously, in the lead role there. Marcia, it does tap into anxieties about raising children, which I guess is universal.
Well, yeah, and this is the first of, I think, many films today we'll be describing as like a dysfunctional family comedy. But what's interesting about this one and others of its ilk is that it ends on a kind of conciliatory note where people come together and some of the rifts are resolved. And so I think even in the dysfunctional family comedy variety, there's often this reassurance at the end that, like, you know, that everything will be okay, as opposed to everything is falling apart.
Well, I really love this movie. And part of the reason is that it's a movie without any bitterness in it. The family feelings are very warm, even as things seem to be falling apart. And there's a wonderful metaphor where Steve Martin talks about family life being like a roller coaster, and you just have to hang on through the highs and lows, you know, and you'll make it through to the end.
Well, Parenthood, of course, looks at a kind of dysfunctional, somewhat more contemporary family. This next film takes us back a little bit, and it is in itself a nostalgic film.
And I would nominate John Ford's 1941 movie, How Green Was My Valley, which is one of my favorites of all time. I think I first saw it when I was about 10. And yes, my grandfather's Welsh. And yes, it was the novel won the National Book Award in 1940. The movie was made in 41 with Walter Pidgeon, Maureen O'Hara, and an extremely young Roddy McDowall, who is extraordinarily bright. He plays the protagonist, narrator.
I am packing my belongings in the shawl my mother used to wear when she went to the market. And I am going from my valley. And this time, I shall never return.
It's the story of a really close-knit Welsh mining family in a very, very small Welsh community. It's about decency and loyalty. Times are changing. And what interested me recently is, why was it so popular in 1940? Probably all of America. It won Best Picture, beat out Citizen Kane. And I think, oh, it's a whole country facing just unimaginable losses. My favorite scene in it is probably the closing scene.
Men like my father cannot die. They are with me still, real in memory, as they were in flesh, loving and beloved forever. How green was my valley then.
There is a clip from How Green Was My Valley, a 1941 film. And Laura, as the listener said, it beat out Citizen Kane for Best Picture. What do you think accounted for that? I mean, obviously the listener's saying here, look, this is a moment in which this is exactly the kind of film we needed to
see. Well, yes, and of course mining is a very, very difficult, hazardous, miserable profession. Yet the family relationships are so warm and so powerful. It really overcomes the hardship and tragedy of what everyone does for a living.
Yeah, there's a lot about labor in this film and about working conditions. And I was struck following on Laura's comment about Parenthood, which couldn't be really any more different than How Green Was My Valley, but that idea of a film that's kind of earnest and sincere and warm. I mean, just even listening to the way that played, it's so antithetical to what we hear nowadays in our films, right? It's just got this degree of almost kind of awkward earnestness. And I think at the time that was a very resonant.
Well, I wonder about that. I mean, films like this and whether or not they're a little bit like ties, you know, keep them long enough, they're back in fashion. Are there moments in our cultural history where we cling to this kind of nostalgic look back and other times in which it sounds kind of clinky and sentimental?
Well, yeah, I think so. But, you know, whether or not I can't comment on how this would play today to an audience. I do know that I've actually never taught this film, but I have referred students to it in the past few years in the context of other John Ford films, and they have all come back very appreciative of what the film is doing. So it's I think it's a film that continues to resonate.
Laura, tell us about your pick, The Family Fang.
Okay, this is a movie from this year that nobody saw, and it's a very bizarre film about some 70s performance artists who had children and then incorporated the children into their performance art, which was extremely detrimental to their mental health to spend their whole lives playing out their parents' art projects.
Children kill art. They just do. You have them, and the passion you had for creative expression becomes secondary.
You know, some people believe that.
I went into a terrible funk, but then the most wonderful thing happened. Near Christmas, we took the baby to see Santa at the mall.
That's my idea. I thought it'd be cute.
We grabbed the camera, we go down there, and I put A on this rancid hobo's lap, and she, of course, screams, but in a way I'd never heard. It was like something conjured by the dark arts, like a horde of demons were gonna fly out of her mouth, and poor Santa's trying to shake her loose. The elves go running for the break room. Families grab their children, run from the light. It was pandemonium and an epiphany for me. I thought, children don't have to kill art. Not if they are the art. For the first time, I thought, hey, I think I want kids.
So that was Christopher Walken, obviously. And what this film is about is the adult children played by Jason Bateman and Nicole Kidman are summoned back to the family home because their parents' car has been found bloodstained and abandoned, and the police think their parents have been murdered. Yet the children think it's just another performance art piece. And so Jason Bateman says, yes, it would be horrible if our parents had been murdered, but if they're not, it's worse. And it really speaks to that holiday emotion of every time you go back home, you say, maybe this time it will be different. Maybe my parents will acknowledge my successes. Maybe my parents will treat my partner with respect. And no matter how many times you're proven wrong, you always go home full of that hope that things are going to be better this time.
We will explore the question further, do children kill art, and much, much more on The State of Things as we look at family movies with Laura Boyce, Marcia Gordon, on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and it is Movies on the Radio Day, this month celebrating movies about families. With me in the studio, Marcia Gordon and Laura Boyce. Marcia is a film professor at NC State. Laura is the film curator at the North Carolina Museum of Art. We talked about parenthood being popular, but this next movie also got a lot of votes. Let's listen.
My name is Cody Hamilton. I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina, and I want to submit 2005's The Family Stone as my favorite family movie. It's a great movie about family because it basically shows the good and the bad. It's a story of the Stone family and five adult siblings who come home for the holidays. One of the siblings, played by Dermot Mulroney, brings home his girlfriend, Meredith, played by Sarah Jessica Parker. The Stone family is quite liberal, and Meredith is not in the least. And it's tension from the very beginning.
You don't have to be nervous.
I'm not.
They're gonna love you.
There's nothing harder than joining a family.
He intends to give that girl my mother's wedding ring.
Especially one like the Stones.
She's got this throat clearing tick. It's like she's digging for clams.
Ready?
They have a funny way of making you feel at home.
Don't dilly-dally there, pretty lady. We're all going to be down here talking about you.
For me personally, it's a great movie because there is a sibling, Thad, played by Todd Giordano, and his partner, Patrick, played by Brian White, and they're an interracial same-sex couple. And for me, I've been with my husband now for 18 years, and this was the first time we actually saw ourselves on the big screen. It wasn't a gay-themed movie, but just the fact that this brother and his partner were just part of the family was refreshing for us to see on the big screen, more than you can ever know.
That's Cody talking about The Family Stone.
Well, that part of the movie is very cool, absolutely. And this same-sex couple is shown right at the beginning to show that Diane Keaton and Craig T. Nelson can be accepting of difference. The character that Sarah Jessica Parker plays is that uptight career woman character that recurs over and over again in comedies in which they have to kind of be cut down to size. dies. And some of the people in the Family Stone are kind of mean to her, which is sort of offsets the accepting kind of heartwarming part of the movie. And I can't but help, because this was written and directed by someone who has not made that many films, that this was really kind of autobiographical about his family. I have no way of knowing that, but it certainly seems possible.
And there absolutely, you can trace a lineage of films that deal with family that are really focused on this idea of acceptance. I was just thinking, as that caller was speaking about Guess Who's Coming to Dinner,
right,
with
exactly.
Sidney Poitier, about you know, about racial difference and coupling, and this is a 1960s film, and so you know, whether it's handled in this kind of lighter comedic way or a little bit of comedy with a little bit of drama, I mean, this is just the reality, is that when someone new comes into the family, there's a lot of different variables, and everyone in the family is going to have a different level of acceptance.
And I would love to give a shout out to North Carolina actor Paul Schneider, who is so hilariously funny in this movie. I really appreciated his work.
Well, a little change of pace now. We're going to take a listen to another movie that qualifies very definitely as a family movie.
My name is Dr. Valerie Ann Johnson, and I live in Oxford, North Carolina. My favorite all-time movie depicting families is Daughters of the Dust by African-American filmmaker Julie Dash. It chronicles the lives of Gullah people at the turn of the 19th century. And I love this movie because it is about our history, the history of American people as they move from a more rural area into an urban area. But it's about these Gullah Geechee people, of whom I'm part of this Gullah Geechee diaspora. I saw scenes there that described and my mother's childhood. She would tell us about taking out the Sears and Roebuck catalog and going through and picking out the things they found that they liked.
I wish I had this doll. I wish I had this doll. I wish I had this bed to go inside my house.
Hot and a young. You ain't got no house.
I wish I did. If I did, I'd put this bed inside my house.
I think what was important was that it gave a very full picture of who African-American people are, what a family can be like, all of the controversy, all of the love, what happens when people go away and come back. The one really difficult part was how a family reconciles when a woman is raped and what that means for the family and what it means for black malehood by not being able to protect the wife from a white rapist.
Same time, the raping of colored women is common as a fish in a sea. You didn't tell Eli who did it, did you? He don't need to know if he get himself killed. There's enough uncertainty in life without wondering what tree your husband's hanging from. Don't tell him nothing.
For all of those reasons and more, I love that movie, Daughters of the Dust.
1991 film, Daughters of the Dust.
Yeah, when it's worth noting that Julie Dash, this film, is the first film directed by an African-American woman to get a theatrical release, and that's not that long ago.
Yeah.
This is a really aesthetically beautiful film. It is slow. It's patient. It's focused on women's stories in particular and the way that history is conveyed through storytelling and through this kind of communion. And the Nana Pesant character, played magnificently by Coralie Day, I mean, I can still hear her voice speaking one of my favorite lines in the film, that it's up to the living to keep in touch with the dead. It's all about memory and history. And it's so different than the vast majority of what gets released in theaters. And it's a really refreshing look at family.
And it also is so beautiful. And
yeah.
It's shot by the seaside, so it's a really unusual background for an African-American story. It's not urban, it's not rural, it's something else again.
It is something else again, and I think that's the thing that struck me both by the film itself, but also in the list of films that we're looking at today. So many of the films that we deal with trade in stereotype, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have a stereotypical idea of what a good family should be, and therefore, you know, let the mayhem begin, because now we'll work against type. But you've got to have that. And this really works against type in so many ways, but not by using stereotype. It shatters it. It
right.
shows a story about race that has less to do with the outside white community, although mm-hmm. that certainly is the shadow cast over the entire film. But it's about arguments and fights within a family
yes.
as normal. These are normal families that, you know, again, don't get portrayed in stereotypical
filmmaking.
It's
an incredibly original film. Yeah. I mean, there's really nothing else quite like it. So very, very much worth seeing.
On the other hand, Little Miss Sunshine, once again, I think we're right back to stereotype here. Here we go.
My name is Tammy Matthews, and I'm calling from Pittsboro, North Carolina. My favorite family movie, in fact, my favorite movie of all time, is Little Miss Sunshine. It has everything from broken dreams to death in the family to supporting your children. It is the most awesome movie to me because everything this poor family tries fails, but they still stick together.
What happened at Sunset Manor?
Frank, don't encourage him.
What happened? I'll tell you what happened. I paid my money. They took my money. I should be able to do what I want.
He started snorting heroin.
You started snorting heroin?
I'm old.
Well, this stuff will kill you.
What am I, an idiot? And don't you start taking that shit. When you're young, you're crazy to do that stuff.
What about you?
What about me? I'm old. When you get old, you're crazy not to do it.
We've tried, believe me. The intervention was a fiasco. It's worse than a two-year-old.
Can we please talk about something else?
And the most important thing to me is the end scene, when everybody goes up during the beauty pageant on stage and supports their daughter in singing an incredibly inappropriate tune.
She's a super freak, super freak.
Hey, let go of my daughter. Let her finish.
There's a clip from right now, Get Her Off, 2006, Little Miss Sunshine.
Well, this can be a divisive movie. Some people think it's too cute. I am on the side that thinks it's really funny. I love the performances in the movie. Alan Arkin is so great.
Toni Collette's great.
Toni Collette, Paul Dano, one of his early roles, and Abigail Breslin as a little girl who wants so hard to be Little Miss Sunshine when it's very clear that she's never going to conform to the stereotype of a, you know, preteen beauty queen. It's really funny.
Yeah, her character, I mean, I just remember when this film came out, you know, kind of everyone talking about that role, that kind of adorable optimism and the way that the family kind of comes together around, even though this is, you know, the ultimate, you know, dysfunctional family comedy.
Yeah.
But,
well, it isn't the ultimate. I mean, this is what I laughed a lot when I, so if you asked me, do you like this movie? I'd say yes, because it made me laugh a lot. But I have to say, there's always this nagging feeling that I have in these films where you basically take this stereotypes, you know, the cranky old grandfather, right. The optimistic young girl that doesn't fit the norm, put them all together, the dad who's trying to hold it all together with his tight lip stuff, and you just say, okay, there's your stereotype, you got the script, right, and you just pedal to the metal, right? Your stereotype is stamped all over your car like a NASCAR thing, and you just floor it from beginning to end. And I think there's a certain fatigue for me that builds in a movie like this about 30 minutes in.
But there are so many films that are supposed to be funny that aren't funny. I don't want to judge too harshly.
But now here's a film that is about a dysfunctional family and not much sweet about it.
This is Curtis Case Feng from Raleigh, North Carolina. And my favorite movie about families is The Great Santini. I love the exploration of the character of Bull Meacham, the great Santini. I think Robert Duvall portrayed a very, very interesting and complex character. My favorite scene in this film, I believe, is the basketball scene.
Now, Dad, the reason I'm going to beat you, Dad, is because you're getting a little fat.
Yes,
says
you, Jocko.
F-A-T.
And for the first time ever, the son wins the game.
Get out of here before I knock every freckle off your face.
That's mean.
Wasn't that great?
Come on, Jocko. You got to win by two baskets.
He said one.
I changed my mind. Let's go.
It's an interesting portrait because you see the father later, in a scene slightly later on, outside in the rain, practicing layups, practicing shots. And his mom, played by Blythe Danner, sits down with her son and says,
"You know why he's down there?"
"No, ma'am."
"Well, I tell you, he's admitting to you that he's getting older,
Now, that is the hardest thing in the world for a man like Bill.
Well, Mama, that doesn't change anything.
Well, it should. You got a strange father, Ben. Well, that's the only way he knows how to say, I'm sorry, son.
Clip from the 1979 film The Great Santini, featuring Robert Duvall.
Well, these images of masculinity that fathers try to convey to their sons can be amongst the most toxic kind of relationship. And since this was Pat Conroy's autobiographical novel, clearly someone who's going to be a novelist is not going to find, you know, some hard-headed, unforgiving Marine father, you know, as the father figure that's helpful for him to try to make sense out of his life. And that basketball scene which, you know, we would watch and consider basically to be child abuse is the one thing that's completely unforgettable about that film.
So now, obviously, there's a big difference between the way fathers and mothers have been represented in film. And it's not that one is more positive or negative than the other. They've been equally kind of fraught and joyous, depending upon the context. But in this case, certainly the fact that this is a military father, you know, plays into this kind of the sternness and the expectations.
Let's move on to another film and another listener right now. This is the film Sounder.
Hi, my name is Carol Lampier. I'm calling from Southern Pines, and my favorite family movie is Sounder.
Yeah.
Hi, Nathan.
And how the Morgan family do while Big Nathan was gone?
Oh, we was just holding on to a string, waiting for you to come and rescue us.
And I'm the best rescuer in the whole parish.
You also is a big bragger, too.
In the movie, the father goes to prison, and the oldest son tries to go to visit him. And on the way, he meets a teacher.
Well, it's a good thing that this hand did not become infected. How did you hurt it like this?
Well, me and Sounder went to this prison camp looking for my daddy, and the guard hit me on my hand.
Did your mother know you were going to see your father?
Yes, ma'am. Thanks, Miss Johnson.
David? Why don't you stay until school is over? I don't live far from here. You and your dog can come home with me and have yourselves a hot meal.
I liked Sounder because at the time that it came out, I had been reading the book to my classes in Alamance County, and I had a newly integrated group. My heart went out to these kids, and especially to the kids that I was teaching. I just felt so strongly that education was the answer for all of them. An escape from their daily lives and also an escape from poverty.
That was 1972 film Sounder, based on the novel by William H. Armstrong.
And this was kind of a revolutionary film when it came out, because this was in 1971 or 72. I was in college when it came out, and the producer of the film actually went college campus to college campus, and I interviewed him, you know, as a like 19-year-old reporter, because it was so unlike a commercial Hollywood film. He wanted to make sure that people who were open to different kinds of movies, you know, got a chance to review it and talk about it, and the fact that it showed this warm, close-knit African-American family, you know, with a dog, which places it, you know, with those other animal movies, you know, with Old Yeller and National Velvet and whatever else. People were really surprised to see a family portrayed in such a humane and universal way.
And I saw that Taj Mahal did the music.
He did indeed, yes. And he was also in it.
Well, Marcia, you chose an oldie but a goodie, 1955, Rebel Without a Cause. Let's listen.
Got anything to say for yourself? Not interested, huh?
Can't you answer? What's the matter with you anyhow?
He's just loaded, honey.
I was talking to Jim.
Well, I'd like to just explain. You see, we just moved here, you understand, and the kid hasn't got any friends, you understand?
Hey, well,
and
we moved into it.
Will you hold it, Jim?
Tell him, man, why we moved here.
Will you hold it?
You can't protect me.
Do you mind if I try? Do you have to slam the door in my face? I try to get to him. What happens? Don't I buy everything you want? A bicycle? You get a bicycle. A car?
You buy me many things.
No. Well, not just buy. Well, we give you love and affection, don't we? Well, then what is it? Was it because we went to that party? Well, you know what kind of drunken brawls those kind of parties turn into. It's not a place for kids.
A minute ago, you said you didn't care if he drinks.
He said a little drink.
You're tearing me apart!
What?
You say one thing, he says another, and everybody changes back again!
That's a fine way to behave.
Well, you know who he takes after.
The 1955 film Rebel Without a Cause, Marsha Gordon's favorite.
This is a film I keep coming back to. I've been watching this film since I was in junior high school and felt a different affection for it then because of James Dean. And, you know, this is the last film that he made. This is a film that came out a few days after he passed away, in fact. And Nicholas Ray, the director of this film, I think, more than any director of his time, had incredible sympathy for young people. And he was really interested in what it meant to be a young person trying to navigate the world. And when this film came out, the always curmudgeonly Bosley Crowther, my favorite reviewer in the New York Times, accused it of being too sympathetic towards teenagers and that it was not sympathetic enough towards parents and police. And so that endears it to me all the more. But I mean, I think it's a film that taps into a lot of key issues of the day, anxieties about juvenile delinquency, you know, the feminization of a post-war culture through the father figure who is like, you hear the mother attacking him. And at one point,
and he wears an apron.
In one scene, but also the hollowness of money and affluence, that not being the be-all, end-all. And I think ultimately it's a plea for kindness and inclusiveness. And it's, it's a film I can watch over and over again.
It went unheeded. We will continue our discussion with film experts Marsha Gordon and Laura Boies on Movies on the Radio in just a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things today, talking about listener favorite movies. I'm Frank Stacio, and I'm with Marsha Gordon and Laura Boies. Marsha, film professor at NC State University. Laura, film curator at North Carolina Museum of Art. So we were just talking about Rebel Without a Cause. This next film is about three child prodigies and their dysfunctional families. Let's listen.
This is Molly Renda. I'm calling from NCSU Libraries at NC State University. And my favorite film about families is The Royal Tannenbaums by Wes Anderson. It may seem like a reach to have a movie about highly dysfunctional, flawed people as your favorite family movie, but it's kind of a family movie of the modern age. The fact that, you know, the Gene Hackman character is kind of a total louse, but he, you know, even in his sort of disreputable way, he liberates these two little grandchildren of his.
Chez has those boys cooped up like a pair of jackrabbits, Ethel.
He has his reasons.
Well, I know that, but you can't raise boys to be scared of life. You gotta brew some recklessness into them.
I think that's terrible advice.
No, you don't.
Take boxing and self-defense classes.
I'm not talking about dance lessons. I'm talking about putting a brick through the other guy's windshield. I'm talking about taking it out and chopping it up.
What do you mean? The mama put you on the road and she went to the police station. When I found out, he gave me a shot to start the investigation. It's against the law. You know, it's about a family, but you might not think of it as a family film. But, you know, who wouldn't want to escape into that life for at least a moment?
It's a 2001 film, The Royal Tenenbaums.
So first off, every single Wes Anderson film is a family film. And I think, you know, in some ways he has inherited Nicholas Ray's interest in family and in young people in particular, because whether you're talking about Life Aquatic or Fantastic Mr. Fox or Royal Tenenbaums, I mean, they are all about the way families have to kind of come together and their disagreements, their points of intersection, and then how they can help each other get through a crisis.
And this one in particular shows how the rules for being a grandparent are so different than the rules for being a parent.
Tell me about it.
Which goes back again to
I got a whole backpack full of Hershey bars in here. Just give them out. Have another one. We haven't yet ripped off a convenience store, though I'm thinking about it.
You only say not what you would never do, only what you haven't done yet.
Only what you haven't done yet. No, but I think you're right. It does sort of tear off. And I think that's it. It's not a matter of working against types. Sometimes it's so shocking that it actually, there are no stereotypes anymore. Yeah. But it does raise a question. One of the things, after doing these things one after another, kind of in series and putting the clips together, I began to ask myself, why is it that all of these families and our real life families actually think they have to stay together? I mean, at a certain point, it's like, well, wait a minute, why don't we just fly apart like we should quite sensibly?
Well, and they don't, because so many of these films are also about divorces and remarriages and people coming in the family and all the kind of, you know, the turmoil from creation and recreation of these units that are, you know, these are social units.
That's
these
right.
are, and that's what makes them so interesting and thorny.
No man is an island.
Oh, there we go. Let's take a listen to another film chosen by another listener.
Hi, this is Katie Soleil from Durham. My favorite movie about families is The Birdcage from 1996, because I think it exemplifies the very best of family, of the broadest definition of family. My favorite scene in this movie is the big reveal after all of the hijinks with the dinner, and the real mom shows up to find that there's already dinner in progress with Albert as the mom, and then they have to explain to the conservative couple.
This is my wife. And this is the lady who had Val.
It's nice to meet you, Catherine.
Very nice, Val. You've done a good job.
Thank you. We're very proud of him.
I don't understand.
Barbara, the nightclub downstairs, he owns it?
Mm-hmm.
You mean he's not a cultural attaché?
No, and he isn't married to a housewife, and their name isn't Coleman, it's Goldman. They're Jewish.
I don't understand.
He's a man. They're both men.
You can't be. You can't be Jewish.
No. Kevin, this is a man.
What?
Don't you understand? They're gay.
I just feel that it exemplifies the most beautiful parts of family, that your family truly can be who you choose for them to be. And it's the funniest movie. It's the movie I go to when I'm having a rotten day.
It is the movie The Birdcage from 1996.
And once again, it's Gene Hackman being a force to confront his real self. Well, the one I just watched The Birdcage again this weekend, and it's hilariously funny and also interesting because Robin Williams was not often asked to play a so-called straight man to Nathan Lane, who really has the comedy role. But one movie it reminded me of was Auntie Mame, in which a couple, or in the case of Auntie Mame, just Auntie Mame, raises a child in the most open, loving, life-embracing way. And yet when they make a choice about a partner, it's somebody very priggish and conservative and narrow-minded, and it's almost a repudiation of what you've learned from your parents. And then, you know, they kind of come around at the end and everyone's happy. But, you know, all I can think of is, well, if they're going to be married and they're 18 and 20 years old, which is very young, this is like 50 or 60 years worth of dinner with this conservative senator and his wife, and I feel a little less optimistic about that.
And let's not forget, this was directed by Mike Nichols.
And written by Elaine May.
Yes, and so this is The Graduate territory. Guess who's coming to dinner? Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And so a lot of thorny, complicated families in the Nichols repertoire.
Yes, but it is definitely laugh out loud.
Do we know how it did critically when it came out?
It was very successful. And I mean, it's even funny looking because Anne Roth has designed these Miami pastel costumes, and then Robin Williams wears these insane Versace shirts, and everything about it just speaks to really creative, original, and delightful people.
Well, family meals, as you pointed out earlier, are the centerpiece of most of these films, and this next one is no exception.
Hey, I'm Natalie Bullock Brown from Raleigh, North Carolina, and I'm a filmmaker, and I contribute to the State of Things Back Channel. I have two favorite family movies. One is The Nutty Professor. It wasn't a great film, but I loved the family dinner scenes.
You know, in my day, Sherman, people used to spend time with their family on Sundays and special occasions, come around and pay their respects. That's your nephew.
Oh, baby's got a little gas. I cooked all this food. Is that all you gonna eat?
Hey. What's wrong with you? You supposed to eat that thing, not scalp it.
Well, Daddy, all the calories in the chicken are found in the skin and in the fat, so I peel
it off. What you talking about? That's where all the fats and calories is. You know where that come from? Watching that damn TV. Every time you turn it on, they got somebody in there talking about lose weight, get healthy, get in shape. Got everybody looking all anorexic, talking about that's healthy. I know what healthy is.
Other film was a little more serious, and that's Soul Food. And that was an important film, I think, because of, again, the representation of the Black family. But in this case, we saw strong Black female characters.
Well, I wasn't in the kitchen because Mama and Daddy kept my head in the books. And that's why I'm a successful lawyer.
And the film dealt with all these different issues, whether it was how does a mother bestow upon her daughters the wisdom and the instruction that will help them to live their lives after she's gone. And then the love of sisters and sisterhood and what that means within the Black family and within the Black community.
And we just heard clips from two movies, and Natalie Bullock Brown, of course, who's here monthly on Back Channel, chose The Nutty Professor from 96 and 97's Soul Food.
So I can't speak to The Nutty Professor. I have only seen the original one. But mm-hmm. Soul Food, I mean, it kind of speaks to, Frank, you had asked this question before about how families even stay together in the first place. And Soul Food, I think, is a really interesting take on that. And so I really appreciate the idea that that this is looking in particular about how women help to hold families together and pass on those traditions.
Well, it should be noted in The Nutty Professor that the entire family is Eddie Murphy. So it really is seeing yourself reflected in everyone around the dinner table. And Soul Food, interestingly, has appropriated that uptight career woman character here played by Vanessa L. Williams. But it is very interesting that it's very sensitive to the place. It's a Chicago family, and they're a middle-class family. So they're, I think they were meant to, you know, be universal in that way, you know, not dealing with more cliched kind of situations.
Well, we talked earlier about films that may or may not make the leap through time or may resonate better at some times than others. Here's a film that has been remade, but we're talking about the 1950 version.
Kathy Zinn. I live in Pittsboro, North Carolina, and one of my favorite movies about families is the original 1950 version of Cheaper by the Dozen, which stars Clifton Webb and Myrna Loy as real-life parents and social scientists, Frank and Lillian Gilbreth. It's a true story of a large, middle-class, turn-of-the-last-century family growing up in New Jersey with a quirky but brilliant time management father and an equally brilliant but softer and more nurturing mother.
Be careful of him, Frank. I don't think hospitals approve of fathers.
Hospitals. Young man, did I ever tell you about the night your mother and I were married when we decided to have an even dozen like you?
You set the actual target, dear. Six boys and six girls. I believe you even made a memorandum of it.
That's right, son. Sounds kind of silly now, doesn't it?
Not half as silly as it sounded then.
I love it because it is funny, wonderfully acted, and reminds me somewhat of my own large family of eight children, of which I was the eldest. And the realities, which are funny and poignant, of growing up in such a household. The fact that it is true only makes it better. And it's a period piece with all the fun that that means. The relationship between the parents, who are truly partners in every sense of the word, is wonderful and a role model of an equal marriage even for today.
And that's a clip from the 1950 film, the 1950 version of Cheaper by the Dozen.
Well, the Galbraiths were efficiency experts, and what they worked on was, for example, how in a factory can you assemble something with the least number of movements. They worked with the military for assembling and disassembling weapons, and so they applied these own philosophies to their family. And one thing that seems kind of hilarious to me now is that Clifton Webb was gay, and the idea that he would be the father of 12 children in this, you know, it's a little bit of a stretch of the imagination.
Yeah. Well, you know, I also think that the fact, what strikes me too, is that he's an iconoclast in the sense. He doesn't like institutions. He doesn't like the way hospitals do things.
Yes.
And they both are. In a sense, they're free thinkers and yet not. I mean, you can't imagine a more regimented formula, more formulaic, who's also bucking the system in a strange way.
But I think it's also interesting that the listener appreciated the parody of the relationship, because if you think, you know, about films of the 1950s, Rebel Without a Cause is a perfect one. It's, I mean, this is not a normal conception in the 1950s. It's abnormal for there to be kind of equal power
well,
in your marriage.
Well, I think it was supposed to be humorous.
Yes.
It was like, look at this hilarious family where the husband and the wife have equal standing. Isn't that funny?
Yeah, it's all kind of wacky and crazy. That should never be. That is something that should exist in a galaxy far away at a time long, long ago.
Hi, this is Chuck Howell calling in from College Park, Maryland. Star Wars is one of my favorite films about family. Family within the original trilogy is obviously a complicated thing, since people don't know who their family is. They don't know who they're related to. You have a lot of kind of sub-families or pseudo-families. It's hard not to think of C-3PO and R2-D2 as an old married couple sometimes, for example.
What mission? What are you talking about? I've just about had enough of you. Go that way. You'll be malfunctioning within a day, you nearsighted scrap pile. And don't let me catch you following me, begging for help, because you won't get it.
And also, you know, as the movies progress, we have the larger family unit, really. I think that the core group of friends and droids and other alien creatures like Chewie form a sort of surrogate family. Luke, Leia, Han, Chewie. Not a blood family, but these are people that risk their lives for each other, give up a lot to save each other in various situations, and there's a lot of love, a lot of love between that core group.
Star Wars, you may have seen it.
Yeah, I've heard of it. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the films that Star Wars descends from is actually a John Ford film called The Searchers, which is about the settling of the American frontier. And it's about family and the fragility of family and also these kind of recreated families, you know, based on circumstances. So it's kind of interesting to think about it in relationship to the way we started the show with How Green Is My Valley, too.
Well, this is a workplace family, basically, you know, like on the Mary Tyler Moore Show or whatever, mm-hmm. where the people that you know work with become your family.
Yeah.
And I guess the great there's a direct line between the great Santini and Darth Vader then, too, is there not?
We will be able to explore all of this tomorrow at dinner with your family and friends. And you can have discussions about your family movies, and I hope it all turns out well. Happy Thanksgiving to both of you. What
Happy
a delight.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Next time we meet, it will actually be the new year when we are together. And at that point, we'd love for you to submit your favorite movie of the year. So you can do that to us, SOT@WNC.org, Twitter, #SOTMovie. Your picks, best movie of the year for our next edition of Movies on the Radio on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.